class from University of Texas at Austin. So Ichiro is has been at Austin for the past 5 years. Is that right?
6 years.
6 years. Okay. And but before that, we used to share the same basement in Princeton. So we go far back. So he used to work on WMAP back then, if I remember. Well, he used to work on galaxy clusters first. I used to work on too. But then he moved on to work on WMAP and various very exciting stuff. And he's going to tell us about some of them on Thursday for this structure formation workshop. Today he's going to tell us about the very exciting result from WMAP.
Thanks, Ramesh. So it's a pleasure to visit PI again. And I think last time I came here, I gave a talk on WMAP 5 year. So it's a pleasure to come back here again to give an update on that. So WMAP will have collected 9 years of data by August. And that's the end of mission. Planck has mapped full sky already, so there's no point for us to continue further. So WMAP will stop observing in August. We will publish probably the 9 year data results sometimes in next year or maybe after that. Then Planck is expected to deliver the data in 2012. So that's the idea. We will have a continuous, a smooth transition from WMAP to Planck.
So what if something happens to Planck?
But they have corrected the full sky already, right?
They have already corrected.
Yeah.
They have collected the
Yeah. So. So that's why. That's why
we're
leading to stop. And this is the WMAP temperature map that you are all familiar with. But this time I'd like to talk a little bit on polarization as well. Something new that we have done. And then, so these are the 6 papers that we have posted to archive back in January. I'll be focused on this one paper that I was leading. And then this is the 7 year team, so we are still sort of small team, made of 20 or so people.
What are the colors?
Colors are, thanks for asking that. So these are the PI and co-eyes of the mission. So these are the key members. And then what's in blue is the people who joined between the period of proposal was accepted, and then the launch of the mission. So these are the people who joined between proposal and the launch, and people in purple are the people who joined after the launch, which is 2001. Then people in black were once in the team, but now left the team and doing some other things. Yeah. So graduates, WMAP graduates. So let me just, before I move on, let me just summarize what I'm going to talk about. So first of all, we detected the effect of primordial helium, pre-solar, pristine helium on the temperature power spectrum. The primordial tilt is less than 1 at more than 3 sigma. Some neutrino parameters are improved. And then polarization map, this polarization pattern is now mapped out to high statistical significance and accuracy. But I'd like to spend most of the time on this sniazolivity effect. I'll try to sort of go through these topics fairly quickly. But please do interrupt me if I'm going too fast. No, this is a CMB plus Hubble constant. Hubble constant is the important part of that. So this is a 7 year temperature power spectrum. And the notable improvement is here. So we are now, let's zoom into the third peak and fourth peak region. And then this is the improvement. So here, the box regions are the 5 year results. And then these points are 7 year results. And as you can see, the error bar has improved, and the points are getting closer to 11 CDM, and then we can now extend the data points out to error of about 1200. So that's the improvement that we have made. Now, this is something that's new. So I'm not in this team of Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is 6-meter telescope in Chile, whose mission is to measure the power spectrum all the way down to N of 10,000. And I'm only showing you the part of the spectrum that's primary, which means this is coming from the redshift of 1,000. If you go beyond this, I'll show you later that the things are more complicated. But at least these are the ACT power spectrum that's out there right now. Very, very small errors, but beautifully consistent with the best fit power spectrum from the Gavi.
Question, have they fitted the parameters?
They have only to WMAP.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nobody has fitted to ACT and WMAP.
I mean, they have.
They have.
But the parameters are basically identical to what you get from WMAP.
What do you mean? If this, you go far beyond.
Right. But in fact, this is something we saw also from Akbar and the Quad. You see all the data points with small errors, but the parameters don't change. There's one, partly because there's, so, One reason is actually statistical error is too large, but another component, which isn't shown here, is a calibration error, which is about 3%.
So that's big enough. ACT has a similar calibration error?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now, let me talk a little bit on Helium. So I'll explain later, next slide, how this thing works, but let me just say, when you have the mass, 24% of the mass in the baryonic matter is in helium, which is standard, Big Bang nucleosynthesis prediction, then you get pink curve. When you have almost zero helium, you get cyan curve, and they are different. So basically, the more helium you have, the more damping of the power spectrum you get, and you see that nothing really is happening on larger scale, but as you go to smaller and smaller scales, you get dumping.
Why isn't there a systematics of the error bars? Seems like it's big somewhere and then...
Which one are you talking about? So here, so basically, as you go to smaller and smaller scales, you get larger error bars because you're more and more noise dominated. Yeah. And as you go to larger and larger scale, your error bar also gets larger because you have fewer modes to sample on the sky. Basically, L equals 2 is where you divide the sky into 4. But here you can divide the sky into lots of pieces and you get lots of data points. Does that answer your question? Yeah, good. Thank you. So how does helium affect? So basically, we measure the baryon number density from the first to second peak ratio. But CMB is interacting with electrons. So what's really important for CMB is what the number density of electron is rather than baryons. The helium, so hydrogen recombines at redshift of 1,000 or 1,090 more like. But helium recombined at redshift of 1,800. So there were fewer electrons at the decoupling epoch where we basically observed the CMB. As a result, if you have more helium, there will be less than the electrons available at redshift 1,000. Now, if there are less electrons, photons can propagate more distance. Now, if your photons propagate more, it wipes out the fluctuations within the mean-free path. So you get more damping over the CMB. And basically, that's the idea. However, you might wonder whether this kind of systematic suppression is, first of all, degenerate with baryon density because you have this, you know, electron number density is related to baryon density. Or NS, which is to tilt the whole thing this way. So if you have NS that's less than 1, you get damping here and up here and so on. So you can just vary simultaneously. This is a very cartoony. This is just one parameter, varying one parameter, but you can't do it. You have to vary all the parameters to see if you can see the effect of helium clearly. And then basically, WMAP alone, so this is the helium abundance here. It's baryon density here. And helium abundance here. And the tilting, NS, here. And basically, doubling up alone, you can't measure helium abundance very well. But if you co-add doubling up data and higher L data that I already showed you, aqua and quad data, then you can detect helium. In fact, we detected helium at more than 3 sigma significance level. This is the likelihood versus helium abundance. This is doubling up alone. This is doubling up plus other CMB small scale measurements. And we see clear detection. Now, standard value is 0.24. So our measurement is consistent. By the way, this is the first time that the CMB alone could detect helium abundance. And this is the pre-solar. Now, why is it important? This is important because, of course, we all know that the helium is here, you know, right now. But some of the helium that we observe are coming from stars. Stellar core, they synthesize helium. So when we say we see helium, we are really measuring the sum of primordial helium coming from Big Bang nuclear synthesis and the helium that was synthesized in a core star. But CMB is different. This is the helium that was there well before any stars are formed. So that's why this can be a very good probe of the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. But current data aren't very well constrained. But the one thing we do know from the lower redshift measurement is that, well, we see helium, and that's a sum of star and cosmological helium. So at least this low redshift measurement will give us a very robust upper limit on the helium abundance. And CMB can provide a robust lower limit on the helium abundance. So if you just put them together, we get something like this. And that's quite good. And of course, the expectation for Planck is much better. Planck is expected to give you the error bar of 0.01. So we expected to get something like helium abundance of 0.24 plus minus 0.01 for the pre-solar. So you don't have to worry about correcting for the helium that's coming from the core of the star. So that will change the game of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Now, we had this improvement in the third peak, and this third peak is measuring total matter to total radiation density. Now, total matter includes baryon and dark matter, and total radiation includes neutrino and photon. So this third peak can give you measurement of neutrino. And so one way to parameterize the neutrino component is the number of the neutrino species. Of course, we know that there are three species of neutrinos. But we can say, OK, at redshift 1,000, maybe there was another component which was relativistic at redshift 1,000, which looks like additional component of a neutrino. But by neutrino, I don't really mean spin half Dirac particles. I don't care what the spins are. I don't care whether they're Majorana or Dirac. All I care about is they are relativistic at the redshift 1,000. Doesn't have to couple to Z, right? In fact, it should.
If it does, it screw up
data. Right, and also it shouldn't couple to photons either.
Yeah.
Because if it does, then you can change everything that we see in the CMB. So it's very weakly interacting relativistic particle at redshift 1,000. And of course, three of them are neutrinos. And the best fit value is 4.3 plus minus 0.9, which is, of course, consistent with 3.
Is it?
But you know, it speaks at 4. So,
Planck. With 2, actually.
So Planck, again, and this is suggestive, it's kind of interesting. Many different people looking at the various combination of data, and they all, you know, pretty much always end up being somewhere at 4. Anyway.
Can I ask you a nice question? Why people wouldn't fit an integer? So if it was a discrete choice?
Because this is the effective number of...
I understand.
Right? Because if you really wanted to make this integer, you're really assuming that they are neutrinos. Because what we are measuring is really... energy density, right?
No, but the additional one cannot be neutrino.
Yeah, but we have this ineffective, but then there's this t to the 4. right? A neutrino temperature is 4 elevenths of third of P gamma, but you know, T question mark could be anything, right? But we are using this to interpret its ineffective.
So if you measure 3 point something, right. If you measure it, it's definitely not 3, but 3.1 with high sigma.
Right.
That tells you for sure there is something else.
And that something else must have the temperature that's way below the neutrino temperature. Right, for one species, their contribution to energy density will be suppressed by T to the 4. So if we find 3.1, the temperature of that component must be lower than neutrino temperature.
This data is just as consistent with 5 as it is with 3.
That's true.
So it could be 2 more.
Sure. So Planck will tell us. I think their expected error bar is, again, something like 0.1. So it's going to be very interesting.
There's a heavy burden on their shoulder. They're supposed to do amazing things as well.
The plant?
Yeah.
That's what. But
think they're
I'm sure they're happy when they are given the plant.
How would they be happy?
Okay, now, so let's talk about CMB polarization. And this is the temperature E mode polarization cross correction. Now, I'm pleased to now say that you don't have to pay attention to this anymore, okay? Because nobody understands what this is, most of the people. But anyway, all you have to know now is that there's a massive improvement from in TE and TB, and TB is expected to be zero. I'll tell you why later. It is zero, but you see that the error bar here and the size of the box are very different. And now we detected TE at about 21 sigma.
But the boxes are what are the points?
I'm sorry. So boxes are the 5-year data, and the points are 7-year data.
Are out of the boxes of
quantity. You mean here?
Right.
So, yeah, that means the previous data was so noisy, huh. Right? Because this is the one sigma error, right? This is only different by two sigma. But from the beginning, right, this first year data, I show this beautiful, I mean, this is one of the beautiful thing, but nobody appreciated it. Because nobody knew, nobody could understand what I was showing. And I was unable to explain what that was anyway. So how can I solve that problem? And this time, I realized that not everybody is living in Fourier space. So we had to just go to real space. And what you see here is a polarization pattern around the cold spot and polarization pattern around the hot spot. So here, you see polarization, right? And this contains the same amount of information that you just saw in this power spectrum. But this is so much nicer. And I will try to explain to you what you are seeing here. And hopefully CMB polarization will make sense to you. So just a little thing as Wayne Hu's celebrated animation. So basically, CMB polarization is created by Thomson scattering, period. But just having Thomson scattering is not enough. You need to have an isotropic radiation pattern around it. So let me tell you why. Because of the way Thomson scattering works, it cares about the incident polarization direction and outgoing polarization direction. When they are parallel, you can get scattering. When they're perpendicular, you get zero scattering. So here, this mode can get scattered because the outgoing polarization vector and incoming polarization vector are. But this one, right, if it were scattered, it would go this way. Therefore, the polarization directions would be perpendicular, right? And it's not allowed. Right? That's why it gets this particular mode is selected. But doesn't mean that you always get polarization this way. Because if you have an electron surrounded by isotropic radiation pattern, this node will get scattered, but that node will get scattered as well with the equal amplitude. So in the end, you don't get any polarization. But if you were surrounded by quadrupolar anisotropy, which means a hot and cold and hot and cold, then you get this node scattered, right? And then that node gets scattered. But then they are with different amplitude here, right? So in this case, the algebraic code will be polarized in this way. This means one very general principle that you always have to remember. The polarization direction is always parallel to the hot region. Right? Hot region is this. So it's parallel to the hot. This particular electron is surrounded by hot in this way. So polarization direction will be always parallel to hot. So if you have hot, and cold, then you get parallel polarization to the hot region. And we have this particular quantity called the Stokes parameter. And this particular configuration, we said Q is negative and U is zero. I'll tell you what that means. This is Stokes parameters. So we have electron here. And then this is east, this is north on the projection of the sky. And we have this polar coordinate. And then when polarization is this way, the vertical, then we say Q is zero, Q is greater than zero, but U is zero. So basically Q is the polarization component that's either vertical or horizontal in this particular coordinate system. It's a coordinate dependent quantity. U is 45 degree tilted. But because it's a coordinate dependent quantity, you want to have some coordinate independent quantity. Namely, if you look at this pattern, you discover that all the polarization patterns are tangential. Right? And you can redefine the Stokes parameter according to this Kamenkovsky, Hosodsky, Stevens paper, that when you have this kind of pattern, you say, okay, I have a tangential, which means in this another new rotated coordinate system, basically you define Q and U relative to point here and point there. And when you have this pattern, right, if you draw a line between here and there, it's always either tangential or parallel. I'm sorry, horizontal or the perpendicular or parallel. So that's what we call Q sub R. And in this case, Q sub R will be always negative because it's always perpendicular to the basin electron.
But the one says it's Q is positive.
Here is Q is positive. This Q in original definition. But if you look at from the rotated coordinate from the point of view electron,
yeah.
Right, in this coordinate system it's actually vertical, right? But from this point of view, it's horizontal. So instead of defining Q and U in the global coordinate system, like east and north, you always redefine coordinate system with respect to that point and your point. So then you redefine coordinate system that this will be north, this will be east from the new coordinate system. Yeah. And this turns out to be useful because according to this previous picture of the CMB polarization, you would expect either tangential or radial polarization pattern anyway. So let me now dig into a little bit of the detail of the CMB polarization. CMB polarization on very large angular scales. And let's imagine that you have matter density, less dense, over dense, less dense, over dense, and so on. Therefore, gravitational potential will be deep, negative, here, where matter density is over density. Then according to this Zaxson-Wolfe formula, basically photon needs to get out of gravitational potential for us to observe. So when you have deep gravitational potential, you get more gravitational redshift, therefore it will appear as a cold spot on the sky. Okay? On a very large scale, when potential is deep, you get cold spot. That blue is cold, red is hot. That's a prediction. Then you use this principle that when you are parallel to hot region, when you're sandwiched by hot region, you draw a line that's parallel to it. Okay. And here you're sandwiched by hot in this way, so you get line like that. Right. Then in the zero crossing of plane wave, this is the crest, this is the trough, but at the zero crossing you get zero polarization.
Now that's mathematically correct and easy to understand all that, but what's really important is this statement is only correct on a larger scale. But that description that's correct for all scales is this. And this is very important to keep in mind, and that was emphasized by Zaldarag and Harrer in 1995. CMB polarization tells you how plasma moves versus that. So basically, because it's over density here, the stuff is flowing in this way. Stuff is flowing in this way. Then plasma falling in has a radial polarization from the point of view of the electron sitting here. And let me tell you why in more detail. This is fun. So the question is, I said you need to have quadrupole radiation in order to create polarization. So let's see how quadrupole is actually created by the motion of the plasma. So you have, again, delta T. In larger scale, it's a Zach-Sprung formula. What that means is in the cold spot, you have potential well. Therefore, stuff is falling in this way. If you take the derivative of the potential, you get acceleration. Right? So acceleration is maximized here, here, and it's zero at the bottom of the potential. Because acceleration is positive, the velocity of electron, well, whatever, is lower here and higher here, and same here. So let's say I'm an electron here, and see what would that electron see as the distribution radiation around the electron. Now in this case, right, now let's imagine that you were queuing up for something, like iPad, right? And then, but in this case, the people before you, people in front of you are moving faster than you are. And people behind you are not catching up with you. Therefore, from my point of view, both of the people are moving away from me. So in this case, you get redshift. So you have cold. But nothing happened in the up and bottom. So I see hot, and cold. If you apply the principle that the polarization has to be radial, parallel to the hot, you get radial. So this is an example where velocity gradient is a source of quadrupole. And this velocity gradient is created by gravitational potential. So around the gravitational potential, you expect radial thing. And if you are at the bottom of the potential, nobody is moving. So so you get zero polarization. But things change a little bit when you go to small scale. Now, so basically people are the stuff is falling into the gravitational well. And so gas gets compressed and raises the temperature because gas gets compressed, right? So if it gets compressed, and then eventually the sign reverses, and the temperature at the bottom of the potential well will become positive. It's no longer negative. So it's basically it gets hot enough so that when photons are climbing up to escape from potential well, they lose energy by gravitational redshift, but it was already hot enough in the bottom so that the net effect is still positive. Now potential is still this and flowing in, but now acceleration gets modified because you get more pressure. So instead of just having derivative of the potential, you get derivative of the pressure. And derivative of pressure is large here. So as a result, stuff is falling in, accelerated, but then as you approach the bottom of the potential, it slows down. Right. So in this case, here the story is the same as before, but here, the people in front of you are not moving fast enough, and so you're running into the people there, and the people behind you are moving even faster. So people get compressed, right? So I see a blue shift here, blue shift there. So I have hot, and cold. So I get tangential. So the polarization virtually reverses. because of the hydrodynamic effect. And that's precisely what we mean by TE correlation. So this the parallel perpendicular polarization around an electron are called E mode. And this is a CLTE polarization pathway that I showed you that nobody understands. So you don't have to worry about this. But basically this two-point real space correlation function.
What do you mean by when you say nobody understands this? I mean, the people who made this part probably understand it.
But you can't see this kind of picture.
They say we don't understand it, but the people who made the plot, right?
Yeah, actually, but people started talking about this first.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then go to the Fourier space, where all the intuition is lost. Mm-hmm. So probably if you are just given this plot, probably still nobody understands what's going on. I can't certainly explain what feature of this corresponds to. And it turns out that these two quantities are related by simple Fourier transform, except where you have J2. Yeah, doesn't really mean anything. But if you go from here to there, then things are really clear. So on a larger scale, TQ correlation is negative. What that means is Q is negative. Oh, I'm sorry, okay, I don't go that fast. It's a TQ correlation, therefore, and let's go to large scale, and let's say T, this is T at the center, and Q is separated by some angle. When T is negative, on large scale, that means it's a potential well. Now here, when T is negative, here, TQ is negative, therefore that must mean that Q is positive. Q positive is a radial. You might have forgotten, but it is the radial. So it's actually a radial. So consistent with the fact that you are flowing in. But as you go inward, it's still radial polarization, but temperature changes sign because now you have this compression on the photon. So photon temperature raises to the positive value, so TQ changes sign. But as you go inward, then you start to slow down. The fluid starts to slow down to the point where Q now becomes tangential. But T is still positive. Right? So you get this sign change again. So this is the point where the gravitational potential and kinetic force are. But there's one extra detail that's interesting. Although it may not be universally interesting for many people, but it's kind of interesting fact that we have found, so let me just talk about it. So what we did was basically to find hotspots and cold spots here and stack them. Right? So we define peaks as the location where first derivative vanishes, so that's a peak. And either it's a extrema or either it's maximum or minima would be defined by the sign of the second derivative. So we use information of first and second derivatives to define peaks. Then let's take hot spots and cold spots and stack them and make a map of polarization. Then that's what we did. So indeed, you get around the hot spot, you first see the tangential, right? Plasma is moving inward with acceleration. But then it changes the sign. So okay, I'm sorry. So first of all, red here, color and lines actually contain the same amount of information. Color means it's radial. I think the red means it's radial. Blue means it's tangential. And the intensity of the color is the intensity of the polarization. And so is the line. So the longer the line, the stronger the polarization. Okay. Anyway, so around the hot spot where potential well is there, it's radial first, but then becomes tangential. Around cold spot, the exactly opposite thing happens. So it's plasma is flowing away from it with acceleration first, so you get radial. And this slows down later, so you get tangential. Right? It's a very nice thing in all of these things that we did here. But when you stack something, And this is a common practice in astronomy. You stack something, and you think that you are measuring the radial profile of something. But that's actually not true. When you stack something, you are measuring correlation function. In fact, now you are measuring peak density correlation function, which is not the same as density-density correlation function, or measuring radial profile. In fact, it's a peak statistics. And in large-scale structure community, it's well known that when you have peak statistics, you have modification of the underlying correlation function by constant factor. It's called bias parameter. But if you work it out detail, in fact, it was done by Vincent Dejacques very lately, a very nice paper. You don't just, so this is again, correlation function, and you have the CLD times J2, and you get constant factor, as is well known. But you pick up this Laplacian, which is L squared in Fourier space. This effect was completely missed by people in the literature. And this was only discovered in 2008. And why is there L squared? It's easy to understand. As I said, in order to define peaks, you need to have information about first derivative and second derivative. But first derivative is zero. So you don't have any term that goes like L, because that term will be zero. But you have this dependence on the second derivative, and that will give you this L squared term. And without this, you can't get an agreement between prediction and simulation. I just skipped one slide. Okay, let me just say. So those who know anything about weak lensing, this is a common practice that's been done in the weak lensing community. This is called galaxy-galaxy lensing. So you have galaxy here, and galaxy image is here, but that's distorted because of gravitational lensing effect due to this central galaxy. In fact, what they do is to measure the shape of the galaxy that's either tangential or radial around the source here. Because that's what the gravitational potential does. Distorted image creates a shear, and it's always tangential around the central galaxy. That's what they measure. But they can't measure shear around the galaxy individually. They have to stack locations of galaxies.
Can you say, what does stack mean exactly?
Oh, yeah, just go out. So you see the temperature there, right? Yeah. Spots. You just add them.
Is the same as binning? Is that the same?
No, it's really just adding. So extract 5 degree by 5 degree patch here.
Yes.
And add the 5 degree by 5 degree patch. And divide by the number.
On top of each other. And you move them around and stack them up. Mm-hmm. Like you really cut it out and put it in a stack, and you get average.
The signal at each point is like.
Yeah, it's really.
How do you know where to put this stack?
You match peaks.
Okay, the centers, you match the centers of your peaks.
So you have a spot here.
Okay.
You have spot there. You have spot there. And each has, you know, temperature value, I.
Right?
Uh-huh. So this is image 1, image 2, image 3. So stack the image will be, in this case,
oh, yeah. And why do you do this?
Yeah, but how do you decide where to partition?
Why do we have to do that?
Yeah.
Because polarization around each temperature, in this case, is too weak to be seen. But we know that polarization around the temperature has some characteristic pattern. So if I co-opt them all, I can beat down the noise and extract the faint thing that you can't see otherwise in original map.
But sorry, what's the criterion that decides where these boxes go?
Oh, so okay, yeah, that's arbitrary choice. I just made a choice. 5 degree. You can do 10 or 20 or 30.
And it's centered around the places that are the peaks.
And in the rotation.
Oh, that's what I missed. It's centered around the peaks.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the troughs.
So I do the coefficient with a fixed coordinate. So I always make sure that.
So
this is north, and this is east.
So you take all the peaks and troughs and that, put boxes of the size you choose around them, and then
in quad.
Do this and stack.
Right.
All
right. That's right.
I missed that part.
So in other words, if you just do this, just extract one region around the spot.
But actually, you're still losing information that way. In principle, you could get more information by fitting it to some standard profile plus fluctuations or something.
So that's actually what people normally do, what we normally do, which is to measure power spectrum from the sky. So when we do cosmological analysis, this is what we do. But so that's fine for cosmological analysis. But here, by doing that, you're not really trying to test this fundamental prediction that there's a specific pattern around the corresponding hotspot. So this is the striking, to me, confirmation that you do see this expected pattern. But if you wanted to get cosmological information by fitting the standard model, this is not the way to do. You have to use power spectrum.
Is it my imagination or is the cold spot cleaner than the hot?
It's your imagination.
It looks like it.
Now, so when people do this tangential shear measurement of the gravitational lensing, this is the formula they always use. Namely, you just assume that whatever you measure in the stacking analysis is a constant times correlation function. But that's not correct. So I think people have to look at it more carefully. That's just a detail.
But you're just talking about the scale-dependent bias.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, we knew this bias becomes scale-dependent on a small scale. So I'm not sure if this
is... But this is even linear scale, right? This is
But here, okay, so the CMB thing, you're defining this, the physics is linear, but you define peaks in a nonlinear way.
Right.
So that's where nonlinear
comes in. Right.
But then my point is that the bias is only constant on larger scale.
Right. But we don't know whether this effect kicks in first, or nonlinear bias needs to nonlinearity kicks in first.
Yeah. So it's a good...
Yeah.
So are you saying that the gravitational lensing people are making the same mistake, or they avoided the same mistake?
They are, I think they are, definitely they are making approximation that's not valid. But how much the interpretation will change remains to be seen.
But I mean, the question is what I said, that we know on a small scale things become nonlinear, so you don't know what you're doing. And on larger scales, this effect is not important. So the question is, like, where does...
Right.
Does this become more important before the nonlinear effect?
Right.
This nonlinear effect, you're saying the
shear
is
nonlinear? Well, whenever you go to a small scale, everything becomes nonlinear.
Small, you mean close to the galaxy?
Right, the separation between galaxy and shear becomes smaller, then you can think of a nonlinear effect.
In less than 10 megaparsecs.
So one thing I haven't shown yet is the simulation data, right? So to just convince you completely that you were doing the right thing, this is a simulated stack image. So I just created one simulation, did exactly the same thing I did for the data. This is what I will get. This is the data. See, that's really beautiful. And now you see that by looking at this, you know that you can now interpret this as the motion of the plasma, right? Plasma is falling in with acceleration and it's slowing down here. Right. Now you know exactly what you're looking at.
That's cool.
Oh, and now, so this is already our foundation, right? But what about the stuff that tilted by 45 degrees? And you can't, now you know that you can't create that by gravitational potential. Stuff has to be falling in, right? It's not falling this way, right? Clearly. So you can't generate that component with gravitational potential. So let's make a map of this. Yes? Now, just forget about the directions. But let's look at the magnitude of polarization that has this thing. So instead of showing Q sub R, let's show U sub R. So this is around the cold spot. This is the same image that I showed you. So structure is formed out with acceleration and deceleration. Now this is a sum up. Namely, I have two frequencies. It's summing up. So I see the signal here. Now I have two frequencies, just difference them. So CME will disappear. And if we, what I'm showing here is a real thing, the signal will disappear in the difference map. Difference between two frequencies. Noise. Now I have two frequencies summed, but showed the 45 dB tilted pattern. And that's zero. We don't see that. Okay. And difference map, we don't see anything. So basically, all these maps are consistent with noise, and we don't see anything that's tilted by 45 dB. What does that mean? That means universe respects parity. So basically, what's happening here is that it takes a skill to draw this. So you see, this is basically the UR pattern, right? So you just have a regular pattern, but just 45 dimensions. But then you have this kind of pattern as well. Right? Anyway. But universe doesn't care whether one particular spot has this or that. If you co-op them, right, it will vanish. Okay, these two correlation patterns are open to time. So unless universe has some preference for right-handed or left-handed, it will simply vanish. Right? And this is characterized by something we call TB correlation. So that particular pattern, the vertical pattern, is called B-mode correlation. And because when universe respects parity, then T and B aren't correlated. But when cosmological parity is violated, then there may be TB correlation up here. It turns out that just like U sub R correlation is a Fourier transform of TE with lesser function of 2, TB is a Fourier transform of the U sub R, vertical motion, is a Fourier transform of TB with lesser function of 2. And then you can imagine the situation where parity is violated. So when you have polarization that was created at rest of 1000, as it propagates, polarization angle rotates. So you can try to constrain how much rotation it has had between us and rest of 1000. But we didn't detect any U sub R, so that puts a limit on that polarization angle. And that's something like this. Now you can do the full analysis instead of doing this stacking, but you do the full analysis using COTB. And this has some interesting implications for Lorentz hierarchy theory or CPT hierarchy theory, all that thing that people are
talking about. This is just for electromagnetism.
It is just electromagnetism.
So it could still have parity violation for something else.
That's right. That's right. That's true.
No, why they say it's electromagnetism? It's
we're looking at the photon, right?
Yeah, but
photon has to be coupled.
But photons are emitted from other stuff. So if say, if your cold and hot spot, or I don't know, if you get plasma, doesn't satisfy.
But we're looking in this case. We're looking at specifically the rotation of photon between now and then. If photon isn't coupled
right,
to anything,
you're right.
Yeah.
So it's just photon.
Just,
right. No, you go ahead.
This parity violating field is homogeneous?
Yeah, now I'm assuming it's homogeneous. So photon everywhere gets rotated by the same amount.
It could be a stochastic.
It could be
field,
stochastic.
And then
that's
you
right.
get zero, but you could have a dispersion.
Yes, yeah. Mark Hammond posted on a paper saying that the distance alpha could be spatially varying.
Or even if you're looking, like you say, this is overall, like everything.
Yeah,
right? I mean, is it possible you could have different
that's
in,
right.
in
that's
big
right.
reach? I mean,
that's right. That's
it doesn't
right.
even have to be stochastic, right?
Yeah.
It could maybe be...
Right, right, yeah. So that's something what they look for. We haven't looked at it, but yeah.
When people do the measurements, are they're measuring linear polarization?
Yes.
Yeah. Does anyone measure... I mean, another thing that could happen is circular polarization be generated by the propagation.
Yeah. For example, when you have magnetic field, the photon propagates, polarization reflection get rotated as well, and then that will create a circular polarization.
No, but that doesn't create a circular, that's just rotates.
Actually, so yeah, the rotation with the polarization is one thing, but the magnetic field can actually give circular polarization as well.
Sure.
But nobody has looked at it.
That's too hard? Is it too
hard? No, it's not too hard at all. It's just a decision, right? So I once actually even asked, so WMAP is not designed to measure circular polarization, but there are a whole bunch of experimentalists who are trying to design new experiments. So I once asked one of them, why don't measure circular polarization when it's so easy to do? The answer was, well, we have finite amount of observing time, and you want to spend most of the observing time on something that's you know, predicted to exist, and something that's exciting, right? Circular polarization is not expected to exist, and so you can just keep integrating on circular polarization. You can't measure circular polarization and linear polarization at the same time. So you have to make a decision, right? Do you want to spend time on circular polarization hoping that maybe you can get something exciting there when it's not expected to be present? Or you want to integrate on something that's, you know, predicted to exist and is exciting?
So there are phenomenological gravity effects that could produce circular.
It's purely strategy for the thing. So when you have, you know, infinite amount of resources and you're willing to spend some of the time on circular polarization, then that's completely doable. It's just a balance between.
So you need to excite.
You have to convince, yeah.
That's right, you need to convince somebody. Okay, so. So polarization. B mode polarization, although B mode polarization can't be correlated with temperature because of particle conservation. But you can also measure B mode correlation function. Right? You can measure variance of B. Although it's not correlated with T, you can measure BB, and that may be non-zero. And that B mode polarization can be created by gravitational waves. Not by gravitational potential, but the gravitational waves can create that. So one can look for it and try to constrain the amplitude of gravitational waves. Parameterized by this tensor to the scalar ratio, R. That's basically saying that when R is 1, temperature isotropy UC is coming equally from gravitational wave and gravitational potential. When R is 0.1, only 10% of the fluctuation UC is coming from gravitational wave. We haven't detected any gravitational waves, that's why UC is defined here. And then horizontal axis is the primordial tilt. And the different inflation models make different predictions in this space, the parameter space. Some models are gone, some models are not gone.
So the different colors are confidence limits?
Oh, yeah, that's right. So this is one signal, this is two signals.
Okay, and that's 7-year data?
This is 7-year data.
So where would the 5-year data have been?
It's the same.
And almost the same?
It's almost the same. Actually, our constraint NS is a little bit better. So two sigma of the 5-year are somewhere here. Just shrinking in this way.
So 5-year data would have allowed maybe that inflation.
Yeah, it was somewhere here.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
But now it's booted out.
Right.
Did this squeeze in the pure scale invariant case? Did the 5-year data change from the? And that's a little outside 2 sigma now.
And it was for the 5-year.
It was also.
Yeah. Actually, in this plane, not much has changed since 5 years. I think we're hitting the wall. We just have to wait for the one. Let me speak by spectrum. That's not interesting. Okay. Now I have a challenge now. This is really the stuff I wanted to talk about, but I have only 5 minutes. But I think I have new thing that's here that's not in the paper, so let me just get to that very quickly. So Snyder's Rich effect is an interesting effect. You have CMB, but then you also have cluster of galaxies. That's a bound object, 10 to 15 solar masses or so, very big. And because they're big, they are video temperature is so high that the electron temperature within a cluster is something like 10 keV, whereas CME temperature is a million electron volt. So electron temperature is very high compared to the temperature of CME. Therefore, photon can get kicked by hot electron here and gain energy. Because they gain energy, they do peculiar thing. So you have this frequency or energy of the photon versus brightness. And of course, CMB is a black body, so you get this spectrum. But when this CMB passes through the cluster, each photon acquires energy, whereas it conserves energy, because it conserves the number density. It doesn't conserve energy, but it conserves the number density because it simply comes from scattering after all. So you get this kind of new spectrum. And this phase doesn't have any change in the brightness. So this is about 217 GHz. And WMAP measures stuff here. Okay? It's 90 GHz and 20 GHz. So for WMAP frequency, you actually see the deficit. Negative temperature in the CME. So you see holes on the sky when you look at cluster location cluster. So one thing that you can look is a coma cluster. Just a nearby, well-studied, massive cluster. And then you see deficit. And I think this is actually the first time that the radio program coma is measured with such a good accuracy. And the reason is the WMAP covers the whole sky. Coma is extended fairly big. It's the extension is about 50 arc minute. And that's pretty big for a ground-based experiment. And you see that temperature is actually declining toward the center. Forget about all these blue and green. Just look at the red. And you see this.
This is after 3 sigma or?
That's 3.6 sigma.
Okay.
What are the points? What are the actual points?
Data.
Data, but what?
Just look at the red.
So it's temperature as a function.
Yes, WMAP data as a function of. No, not average. Oh, yeah, it's a spherical average.
Over annual lie, I guess.
That's about 219
the red,
so that you don't see any
deficit? Okay, now I have to explain that. So WMAP has multiple frequencies, but here I'm showing you only two frequencies here. Okay. Now, so green is 60 GHz, blue is 90 GHz, right? But, and I think this is new. So you have Snell-Zeldovich effect, this right scattering effect, but you also have CME fluctuation. You have CME fluctuation, on top of that you have the negative deficit of the cluster. If you have only one frequency channel, you can't distinguish whether what you see is a CME fluctuation or cluster. But if I have two frequencies, I can distinguish them because the SE effect is clearly non-thermal. Right? So it gets different effects as a function of frequency. So when I combine these two, I can separate CME and SE cluster contribution. That's why this red is actually less significant than blue or green. This is new. I mean, what we actually found is that the coma cluster region has a CME fluctuation of negative 100 microkelvin.
So
it's unfortunate coincidence.
So all I'm supposed to do is pay attention to the red.
That's right.
Okay, I guess you're going to tell me I'm not going to have to worry, but I ask anyway. I only really see this decrease for the two leftmost points here. If I forgot about that, I'd see those things consistent with zero.
You're right. Unless you have a model, right? So you have a model.
Well, sure, and right. Some other guy might have a model, or some other person has a model where it does something different, right? So it's really,
right.
I mean, I must admit, I'm not really persuaded by this at this point in time. Should I be?
You should be.
Okay,
but but you are right. You see, this isn't 10 sigma detection.
Mm-hmm.
If you are 10 sigma, then you will see multiple points with small arrows. But it's always 3.6 sigma. So you know.
But it's really, I mean, the action is in that, you know, 50 arc minutes and less sector.
That's true. I mean,
so there's not much data there.
But that's the size of the cluster that you expect.
Yeah, size of the cluster is about this.
Yeah, but still, it's really not.
That's fine.
Highly persuasive.
Yeah. It is not highly persuasive. I agree. Although, so all we can say is, we detect comma cluster SZ with expected address extension, with expected size. Right.
What am I to make of all that stuff rightward of 100? Does that mean anything?
It doesn't really. So.
Because it looks like it goes up and down. And
yeah. It might not, but one thing I have to say is that these all data points are actually highly correlated. So these can be driven to negative because it's negative here. This data was not independent. But real question is, so are we really detecting, so for example, this is caused by hot gassing cluster. You don't have to use SZ effect to detect hot gassing cluster. It's hot gas emits X-ray. So the question is, you take X-ray measurement, trying to predict what would be the SZ effect that you're seeing, and see if they're consistent. Okay? So are we detecting the expected amount of electrical pressure? One thing that I forgot to say was that the SZ effect is proportional to electron pressure. It's a very nice measurement of pressure. So three approaches. Compare WMAP data and X-ray data on the same cluster. So for example, comma. I measure SZ on a WMAP, a comma. I measure X-ray on a comma, and just compare apple to apple. This is the best way to do it. I can do it on comma. I will show the result, actually, in the next slide. But not all clusters are detected individually by WMAP data. So if you wanted to extend this to many other clusters that are detected in X-ray, I have to do stack again. But then you have to be careful, because stacking analysis is often very hard to interpret. So you have to control systematic effects. This is best. This is not best, but this is all you can do. Or you can also compare that to theoretical expectation. After all, you want to do cosmology with it. So instead of just comparing X-ray to SZ, you would compare that measurement to this theory and see what you are. I don't have time to go into these two parts, actually, unfortunately, but let me just show you the first one because this is the new, that's not in the paper yet. So for X-ray, okay, there was a people, unknown at all, who came up with this fitting function for the average electron pressure profile as a result of averaging 33 nearby clusters. In other words, this is not individual cluster measurement, this is more like the falling into this kind of category. Okay? You measure average temperature pressure profile from the X-ray. This is one thing to compare to. Not the best thing to compare to, but one thing to compare to. And this is also where all the theoretical people are comparing their results to. Okay? So you can take this as the best thing that we have for theory. I'll only probably 2 or 3 minutes to finish up. So this is Arnold et al. Profile. As measured from X-ray data, this is a bunch of X-ray data, 33 clusters. You see that the average does go through the average, but you have significant scatter among them, right? Mm-hmm. So this is good in average sense, but not for individual clusters. So the best thing you do is to compare apple to apple. This is new, okay? Again, this is a comma cluster, WMAP measurements. Now it's log scale, that's why it looks more significant than before, but the data are the same. As a function of angle, at 3 data points. This black curve here is this expectation from unknown pressure profile. And they are off. The WMAP data is below the unknown at all. I was worried about this a lot and trying to figure out what's going on. But then I contacted this X-ray people, Alexey Finogenov in Max Planck, and he kindly gave me X-ray data on the comet. Mm-hmm. And that's here. If I compare that to unknown at all, it's off. In fact, it's not the same amount, right? If I multiply its angle by 0.64, it can fit both the WMAP and X-ray. So in fact, what we see in the Dagger data is consistent with X-ray data on the same cluster, but it's inconsistent with whatever people are using as evidence for that. Okay?
But of course, you already mentioned that there's a larger scatter, so some individual clusters don't have to match.
That's right. But just one cluster. What about the other clusters? We measure the CPX of a very nice sample of Wilson in the other cluster. Actually, we can't measure SC in all clusters, but I can measure the SC cluster, the SC effect on quite a few clusters, like 12, right? So this is just one example. So this is the data again, and sorry, these are unknown at all. Adele, whatever. So they are all measured. Some of them are significant detectives, some of them are not. You just average them to get overall normalization factor for adult at all. If I average very high mass clusters, meaning mass of greater than 6 × 10^4, 10 to 14, I think 5 are these without coma, I think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. Now again, normalization 0.7 plus minus 0.13. If I include less mass clusters, I get the smaller normalization. So in average sense, it is actually seeing a smaller SD than was expected. Now why is that interesting? This is all stuck in this, it's just a basic joke. This is the best you can do, but it doesn't beat this individual class analysis I just presented you. That's far more convincing. So this is interesting because now this is SPT, power spectrum, ACT power spectrum I was promising to show. So now this L, this is where I stopped showing the data when I showed you the W7-year power spectrum. Now it goes all the way up to L 8000, right? And you see this turning. That's coming from basically radio point sources that you couldn't remove from the data. Now, ACT people's power spectrum is completely dominated by point sources, but SPT people using multi-frequency data could separate point source and from other things. So this is the result of removing as much point source as possible. And you see here, the data here, that's coming from something else called, again, SZ. So you have clusters unresolved, each giving you some temperature decrement. If you collect them up and measure power spectrum, you do see some extra contribution from thermal SZ. That's fine, that's well known for that, except the power spectrum in SZ that they measured is 40% to 60% times expectation, right? And then there are two solutions. You don't have to worry about this complication, but let me just say in words. There are two possibilities. One, there are less clusters than we thought are there. This is the power spectrum. You're collecting a bunch of clusters. If there are less clusters, you get less power. That's one possibility. Another one, there are same number of clusters that we expected, but individual cluster is fainter. And this power spectrum analysis can't distinguish between the two. But our measurement, I think, actually does indicate that the solution is that the individual cluster is actually fainter than expected. But X-ray measurement and SC measurement are consistent. It's just our expectations wrong. Right? So we just have to revisit the theoretical prediction. And I think I'll just finish off. So summary, we detect, so we have significant improvements in high atrium pressure. We have significant improvement in polarization of all multiples. NS is less than one. Polarization is detected on the sky. And we detect the gravitational wave. We put some constraint in parity violation. But at the moment, what I'm most excited about and also equally puzzled by is that somehow pressure in the cluster is less than what we thought there was. But somehow nature already knows about it. The X-ray and the SD are actually consistent. So we just need to revisit our understanding of what's going on in the cluster. I'll stop here. Thank you.
So questions for each year? Okay, so let me start off. So are you comparing apples and oranges because X-ray sees the internal parts of the clusters, but SD sees all everywhere, so...
So if you look at the coma, that's not cannot true, right? These are the same scale.
But of course that's where the agreement is, so that's fine. But I mean the other comparison with...
Okay. So
yeah.
One thing that's missing here is actually the comparison of these data with X-ray data.
Exactly.
Which I haven't shown here, but I have the data.
Mm-hmm.
I just got one from Bickley.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll try to do that before I...
So you have the pressure profile from X-ray?
Yeah.
But I mean, of course, he's fitting something or... Because you cannot directly measure pressure. What you directly measure is extra luminosity and extra brightness.
But that's good enough, I think, because he does it on a cluster by cluster basis.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good enough.
But don't you agree that X-ray is the inner part and SDC is the outer part? So.
They can go to actually R500
mm-hmm.
for all of these classes, because these are big.
Mm-hmm.
But they can actually go all the way up to R500. So these clusters, I think, we're seeing the same thing.
Okay.
But one, I think, the caveat is that X-ray is measuring n squared, right?
Yeah.
But pressure is n.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful how this n squared average is related to n other squared.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be where we're misinterpreting the results.
Other questions?
You said the theoretical expectations for this Ix/Zeldovich effect are greater than what you see.
That's right.
So what are they? What are those theoretical expectations based on?
So based on hydrodynamic oscillations. So that's basically what the expectation is. And these hydrodynamic oscillations contain lots of complicated physics such as star formation, gas cooling, gas heating. These simulations are then calibrated to match some of the observations, like I don't know that all I showed you. But I showed you that curve is actually off.
You said that's off. So if you correct the simulation to match the corrected curve, would that problem?
Yeah, so that's the question really. Can we actually explain this deficit in the SZ by some thing that we haven't put in the hydro simulation? Or can
already,
we do that by turning knobs?
You're already saying they're using the wrong parameter, if I understood. You're saying they're normalizing the hydrodynamic simulation.
By turning the knob, that's right. By turning the knobs of this star formation or gas cooling. So, but it's not guaranteed that we can explain all of this by simply turning the knobs. Maybe they can, maybe they cannot. It remains to be seen. But first of all, I have to convince people that actually we are seeing the deficit in SZ. That's not trivial. So, but I think this is quite an interesting case for the deficit of SZ.
Can you show that plot where the SPT and add if I naively just add more clusters, then the deficit will be
That's right. If you, for example, are wrong by, you know, if your sigma I value is less than what we infer from CMB, then you can explain this. So really, is this sigma I that's low or is the gas pressure that's low? I think this one is more like.
You see a deficit in each cluster.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so it's not, it cannot be something like cosmic strings or something.
But unless
it's
you have a lot of cosmic strings.
You would have a string per cluster, which is very...
Unless the strings frustrate at the cluster, so,
yeah.
So you have a lot of them.
But if you have some source of SW in each cluster,
yeah.
It's stronger.
Yeah, I think I know that the claim we have detected clustering, we have need to have a lot more observational evidence than just this.
Okay, so on that note, so let's thank you, Chair, again.